Show. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very, very happy to be sitting opposite Nan Calvert today for today's morning show. Due to a calendar snafu on my part, I wasn't here. I was out of town when Nan paid her July visit to the morning show, so she was in the capable hands of Dave McGrath, but I am glad that I am here today to welcome Nan Calvert and to help her welcome a very special guest to the morning show. First of all, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back.
Thank you so much. We missed you, Greg, but we held the fort down for you.
That's good. And you're having a good summer, I hope?
Yes, it's a very good summer. How about you?
It's been good. It's been real good, and I'm happy to be healthy and happy. I actually was sick most of the month of June, came down with a very nasty parasite, actually, and got medication and got all fixed up and feeling good now again for the most part, at least.
So, see, that's what you get for trying to eat healthfully, Greg.
That's right. Watch those veggie trays. Mostly green things are wonderful for us, of course, and that's part of the whole point of what we want to talk about on today's morning show. So our special guest joining us via telephone is John Holzwart. And Nan, before we introduce him, tell us how you came to know him.
I was thinking about this the other night, and I just confirmed this with John before we went on air. I have a very, very dear friend named Claudia Wagner, and she lives in Augsburg, Germany, and has much of her life. Somehow or another, she connected with John, and there's a piece of beekeeping equipment called bee pipes that are used in Germany, but apparently are not particularly common or difficult to access here in the States. And so Claudia provided John with bee pipes and actually came to visit him. And Claudia's been here at my home many, many times. So that's actually how I connected with John. Here we both live in Wisconsin, but a woman from Germany introduced us to each other.
and the rest is history.
And the rest is history, that's right.
John, we're really happy to have you join us. I know you are based in Sheboygan, but you're actually speaking to us from New York State today. And tell us why. What brings you to New York State?
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to be here on home with you. But I'm born and raised in Sheboygan. I am currently in New York because I'm hired as a historic demonstrator. In 2005, I learned how to make brooms. I took a class. And after about a month or so of reproducing that first broom, I found my teacher, a man by the name of Dan Raisinger, who lives way up in northern Wisconsin now, I believe maybe in Hurley. But he taught the class, and then I spent the day with him one-on-one learning some other styles of brooms. And that was pretty much all I needed to keep running with it. So I, at the time, I was working in a factory in Sheboygan, and they closed the doors in 2007, and I thought, wow, maybe I can make a go of this broom thing. And thankfully I was able to cash out my 401k and pay off my mortgage, and here I am today. I'm a full-time broom maker, among other things, actually. But right now, I'm traveling. I'm bouncing from county fairs. I'm doing five of them in New York State. It's my van and my canvas tent and all my broom making equipment, and just trying to educate and entertain about brooms and broom corn and some broom lore, broom history. Yeah, I never thought I'd have to be a broom maker, but it just kind of happened.
Life has these wonderful surprises for us sometimes. That's great. So my understanding is that you are the owner of something called Plant-Based Services, which I think is involved in all kinds of different things. Tell us about Plant-Based Services.
So in 2015, a 12-year relationship ended, and a partnership that I was part of, business went with her, and I started my own business called Plant-Based Services, which basically just encompasses many of my passions or obsessions, some people might call them. But yeah, of course, the brooms are the meat and potatoes of it. But I'm also a beekeeper, and I do bee removals for people where I remove and relocate honeybees from people's buildings and structures. I also teach a variety of different classes. Every March, actually, I teach a bunch of different at a bunch of different locations around Wisconsin, Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, where I'm teaching grafting classes. So fruit tree grafting is another passion of mine. I also teach edible and medicinal plant classes and lead plant walks. Some people have called me a Renaissance man because I have such an eclectic collection of things that I do and enjoy.
So tell us a little bit about your childhood and growing up and kind of young adulthood. I'm really curious to know kind of how life's path ultimately took you to this really interesting place where you are. I don't mean geographically, but in terms of what you are doing and all of the different ways in which you are using your own interests and skills. Can you point to anything that kind of explains this?
Well, so, you know, being born and raised in Sheboygan, I, you know, living close to Lake Michigan, I'm an only child, and I was lucky enough that my grandfather built a, like we called it, my clubhouse in the back. And so I would regularly go down by the lake and pick up sticks and stones and bones and antlers or whatever I could find, and my little clubhouse, you know, became quite a menagerie. And I've always, you know, enjoyed just you know, being, you know, in the woods or in a natural place, close to nature, and learning about my surroundings. And also, I've always enjoyed, you know, making things and creating things. When I was, my mother liked to remind me of a story of daycare. It was maybe I was 4 or 5 years old, and there was a local art center that had some sort of a day thing where kids would go, and they'd make all kinds of little, you know, doodads and thingamabobs with clay and toothpicks and popsicle sticks, and everyone... All the other kids came out with a paper plate with a couple little things on it, and well, here comes Johnny with a coaster wagon with several paper plates on it. So that was me as a you know, a young person. And as I went through school and continued to you know, have a passion for making and building and being close to nature, it just kind of followed me through my life. When I moved out of the house at 18 or 19, I moved into what some might call an animal house, you know, a steady diet of pizza and beer, and I started to realize, you know, that there's a lot of free food around me, and I'm a pretty thrifty guy, you know, being a Wisconsinite, I've learned a few things. I like to jokingly say my dad is so tight he squeaks, but So the drive was there to go and learn about edible plants. And a neighbor actually took me out in the woods, and we went morel mushroom hunting. And from then on, I was even more hooked than before on getting out and learning about wild mushrooms and edible and medicinal plants. And that has just continued to, you know, be part of my life.
I know that something else that you have become involved in, and I believe this is in its infancy, you've just put this together, is a nonprofit which you're calling Arboreus Incorporated, which, according to what I've read, is created to advocate, support, and create edible landscapes in the urban environment. So it sounds like this is something that takes some of your own interests that you've already been touching on, but applies it in a sense in a different sort of landscape than the one in which you live. Explain what Arboreus Incorporated hopes to do.
Yeah, well, so I sometimes I take it for granted that, you know, like, not everybody does what I do, and not everybody knows about plants and, you know, how to grow food sustainably, you know, with little inputs. And so I want to encourage people to grow perennials, fruit trees, berry bushes, even perennial vegetables. I mean, asparagus and rhubarb are just the start. There's a plant that I'm really excited about recently called, it's called sea kale, native to the beaches or the coastline of Scotland. And so it'll grow wonderfully in our area, very cold, hardy. And it's perennial. It's a perennial vegetable. It's not an actual kale. So there's so many things like that that I can, you know, bring to public light and inspire people to, you know, be part of this venture, whether it's going to be, you know, volunteering their time or helping to secure grants or funding or whatever. And I would like to continue to, you know, secure vacant lots in the city, you know, and to, you know, eliminate any sort of blight that might be happening. You know, I mean, why have the mowers come through regularly or at all when we can have locals in the neighborhood tend that lot and have, you know, the harvest and also propagate plants on the, you know, from the existing plants that are there. So I hope that this you know, endeavor will just continue to mushroom. You know, it's in its very early stages. You know, I got my last documentation okayed from the government right before I left on my trip with all the fairs here. And so I did get a lot of positive response when I posted it on social media. And, of course, when I get done in the fall, end of October is when I'm done traveling to fairs, I will definitely be putting more attention to it and looking for more input. And, you know, it's exciting to see what the future is going to bring.
John, you secured an open lot next to your home, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And that was, thank you. That was a one of the things that really, you know, got me thinking about this. Because so the story behind that is I purchased my home when I was 22 years old. I started working in a factory, and, of course, I had all this extra money. Well, now, you know, I want to keep growing and doing more things. And so last June, you know, it's hard to believe it's been over a year, but I purchased this vacant lot that the city, you know, had up for sale. And I'm pretty glad that I got a good deal on it. And I started planting fruit trees, and I did some landscaping where I was able to dig down certain areas that I knew would collect water. So that way I don't have to irrigate. I don't have a way to irrigate until I build some sort of a way to, you know, do rainwater catchment, maybe with a garden shed or something. And, of course, these are all perennial. So while I'm on the road, I don't have to worry about, you know, planting or replanting or anything like that. I, you know, they're just going to be there growing, and hopefully in the fall I'll have at least a little taste of something off of the fruit trees I've planted.
What kind of fruit trees have you planted? And also, can you tell us a little bit about your passion for Cornelian cherries?
Yeah. I guess saying it's a passion is putting it mildly, because it is one of my obsessions. So this is a tree, the Cornelian cherry, it's Cornus moss, right? So it's a dogwood, and there are not many dogwoods that produce an edible fruit. Many of them produce fruits, but they're either very bitter, high in tannins, things of that nature. And the Cornelian cherry the flavor is almost like a cross between a sour cherry and a cranberry, but it grows on a tree. And because not many people grow it, there's few disease issues with it. You know, everybody grows apples or pears, you know, and so then because there's so many apple trees and pear trees, and you've got these giant orchards with these huge monocrops, you know, disease festers. And so, you know, like what I'm doing with this vacant lot, you know, I'm planting a polyculture, mm-hmm. you know, because if something gets in and starts chewing on one tree, it cannot jump to the next, to the next, to the next, and spread like wildfire, because I've got a diverse mix of trees. I've got some persimmons planted. I've got pawpaws planted. I do have some Cornelian cherries. But, you know, and even though I love that tree, I really had to resist not wanting to plant the whole lot full of Cornelian cherries, because that's a monocrop. You know, we want a polyculture that's going to be mimicking nature in the whole permaculture model. If anyone is familiar with permaculture, this is what I'm trying to, the mind of thinking here that mm-hmm. I'm trying to work with.
You worked at a factory as a young man. How did you mm-hmm. learn to graft fruit trees? How did you find mentors all along the way, combined mm-hmm. with being self-taught? How did you become such a font of knowledge?
Well, yeah, I mean, I took a fruit tree grafting class at the Midwest Organic Farming Conference in La Crosse. And maybe that was in 2005, something of that nature. But pretty quickly I started to look at, you know, wow, what can I do? What else can I graft? Or, you know, where can I get more cuttings? And there's the world of fruit tree grafting is can be really fascinating, especially to folks who aren't familiar with it. I mean, there are varieties of fruit trees out there that have been passed down from generations. You know, they just, you know, take another cutting and graft it to another tree. Montmorency cherry, very common cherry, was a seedling cherry tree in France in the 1700s, and we still grow it today. There are apple varieties out there that were around during ancient Roman times. So, you know, learning how to propagate these fruit trees and continuing to share that genetic diversity is really been, you know, a gift to humankind.
When you are thinking about the Arboreus Incorporated project, I wonder what relationship this has to the urban gardens that we hear so much about. Do you necessarily think of this, or should we think of this in terms like that, that are, in a sense, that organized? Or do you envision something that is, in a sense, wilder and kind of left on its own in a sense? Do you just want there to be these things kind of growing spontaneously in urban settings? Or are you not even really certain about that yet?
Well, I think that that's a both and, you know, it's not an either or. So there are some gardens in Sheboygan, and there's one in particular. I donated a couple of fruit trees to their garden, and so they have them on the edge of their plots, and they're in back, so they're not shading anything out. They're on the north side of the little parcel. So I mean, I think fruit trees have a place in those community gardens. And I think that there are plenty of vacant lots that could be turned into a food forest where you have these trees. And, of course, trees would be selected that are not going to get monstrous, right? You know, I mean, I personally would not want a 30, 40, 50-foot tree in the city that then ends up becoming a danger, right? So the trees that I'm planting typically stay 20 to 25 feet tall, they'll be more, you know, easy to manage that way, if that answers your question.
Right. So this thus far has been this notion, this idea, at least in principle, has been so far enthusiastically received from the sounds of it.
Yeah. It's an idea that I've thought about for a while, and I've thought about trying to, you know, purchase lots or vacant land in my area just on my own. And, you know, I think this needs to be more of a community effort, really. You know, I think that it's going to take a village to really bring this to light that, you know, hey, planting perennials, you know, is going to be so much easier than, you know, tilling and replanting or mowing. You know, I mean, let those areas go wild in certain places that, you know, you want your pollinators to come through, right? If we're mowing down dandelions, you know, our bees don't have food. So I think that it just needs to be some education. And, of course, we want things to be aesthetically pleasing. Wood chips for pathways through these food forests would still, be a pleasant experience. And on those wood chip paths, you can inoculate those with mushroom mycelium. So then you're not only growing food around you, you're going to have mushrooms you can eat on the path in front of you. Mm-hmm. So there's levels, there's multi dimensions to these food forests that really are just, I don't know, it's just amazing to me, you know?
Well, and it sounds like, as far as you're concerned, it's kind of a no-brainer win-win situation.
Yeah, exactly. Because if people get involved and they, you know, help to maintain or help to harvest or help to propagate plants, you know, they get to take home plants and they get to be part of something that hopefully will enrich their lives too.
So, John, the vacant lands or open spaces that you hope to secure, those will be then owned by Arboreus, correct?
That's my thought.
Okay. And I'm curious, you know, reading over your mission statement and your vision statement, you know, the communities obviously would have all kinds of input into food harvesting and maintaining these gardens and orchards. I'm wondering if they're in the future, if you're thinking about having then communities purchasing those lots or sort of jointly owning those lots with Arboreus.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. You know, I mean, this, I just imagine that this whole thing is just going to be organically growing in, you know, who knows what directions. I mean, some people wonder, you know, well, will you help bring this or support other parts of Wisconsin other than just Sheboygan? And if I can, I will. You know, who knows what the future brings? I found that if I just stay rigid and not open to change or not open to different ideas, then things can get stagnant, mm-hmm. and it gets hard, you know. So I'm open to other ideas, and of course there's going to be a board of directors here. There's only a couple people now on the board, which is a couple friends of mine, but I mean, a nonprofit has to have regular board meetings. And then, of course, there's going to be, you know, planning and things of that nature. So, yeah, it's a whole new world for me.
Yes, it certainly is in the infancy stages. All of those things that are sort of behind the scenes, if you will, that have nothing to do with growing or harvesting fruit or you know, teaching people what to do with it, all of those things that no one sees.
And this is something, and this is something at the moment that where you are focused on Sheboygan itself, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it needs to start small and start somewhere. So that's where I live. And, I'm excited about the prospects and curious about the future.
Yeah, nicely put. We're speaking with John Holzwart. He is based in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, owner of Plant-Based Services, and also has created this nonprofit called Arboreus Incorporated, in which he hopes to transform vacant lots in the Sheboygan area into edible landscapes, so primarily with fruit trees that could be of benefit to the general population. John, I want to be sure to talk for just a couple of minutes here about all of the work that you do with bees. You yourself, a beekeeper, mm-hmm. and one of the intriguing things on your website is that you say that you can work with people who would like bees at their location or who want bees relocated. In other words, whether somebody wants mm-hmm. bees where they live or doesn't want bees where they live, you are able to do something about that. Although we hasten to add, you are not in the business of killing bees, but very specifically of relocating bees if there are bees that are a nuisance for somebody. Explain the process by which bees get relocated.
So, let's back up a little bit. A colony of honeybees, right? They're what they would call a super organism because they all function together as one. A lot of people think, oh, the queen tells them what to do. No, the queen is the egg layer. You know, she's the baby machine. But they all work in consensus together. You know, they use pheromones to communicate. To me, it kind of reminds me of, if you've ever watched Star Trek, it reminds me of the Borg, you know. And so, you know, they work together. And when resources are good, they will take in more nectar and pollen, and then they will raise another queen, and then they will split in half, and they call it a swarm. This swarm will take off, and many times it will have, you know, 40 to 60% of that colony. And so the hive had a baby. Yay. So that hive, that colony, that new swarm will take off, and they can, you know, in the urban environment, that colony, that swarm can end up living in someone's wall or the soffit under their edge of their roof or wherever. And so I have, so this equipment that I've purchased is the main piece of equipment that I really need is called a bee vac. It's a special vacuum that is mounted onto the onto a hive body, a box, and it has a baffle on it that I can dial down the vacuum pressure so that I don't smash the bees when they get sucked up into the box. When I come into someone's home, first, of course, I'll assess the situation. Where are the bees coming out, outside? Where are they going in? And then I will find that space inside, and I will cut a hole in the drywall or plaster and lath if it's an older home, and I'll begin the removal process. So one by one, I'll take out the combs, and I will vacuum the bees off of the combs and into the box. And then, I'll find the queen, and I have a special cage for her. I'll put that in my pocket to keep her safe. And once I have all the combs and the bees vacuumed up, of course, any comb that has larvae in it, that will be put in another box so that I can reunite the bees with their babies. And when I do that, I'll reunite everybody at my place or another bee yard that that I'm keeping bees at. There's a few people that, you know, want bees at their place, or friends of mine that let me keep bees there. So I kind of keep an eye on them, make sure that they bounce back, because it is traumatizing. I mean, I tell people too, you know, can you imagine you're sitting on your recliner watching TV, and all of a sudden the roof of your house gets ripped off and a giant hand comes in and takes you out? You know, it's kind of traumatizing. But it is the most humane way that I know of relocating these honeybees. You know, many people might be aware that, you know, last few years we've had a hard time with bees, and it is challenging to keep them alive many times, because honeybees are under threat from not only agricultural chemicals, but viruses, bacteria, fungal issues, mites. There's several different types of mites that attack bees. So, you know, we need to really do all we can to support them, you know, as pollinators. And even native bees, you know, our native bees really need a lot of support as well.
Thank you for mentioning native pollinators.
Right, because that's of course something that most people don't realize, is that what we think of as the common honeybee is actually not native, and maybe that's part of what makes it kind of have a fragile relationship with its environment, and that there are other pollinators too. But in the meantime, so you're working really hard to keep these valuable honeybees alive and well. And of course, you also go through the process if somebody wants bees on their property. Does that mean if somebody wants to be a beekeeper, or just simply wants bees introduced into the area where they live? Do you do both?
Yeah, I do both. I've taught many beekeeping classes, and you know, and I'm also willing to I was lucky enough that I had a beekeeping mentor when I first started out. I was purchasing honey in bulk from a local beekeeper, you know, buying honey by the 5-gallon bucket and jarring it up and selling it at fairs and festivals. And finally, you know, after years of him kind of, you know, nudging me and, you know, encouraging me to try to take up beekeeping, I finally said, okay, let's do it. You know, he said, I'm going to order some bees now from the local supplier, and you know, I've got an extra couple hives if you want them. And like, how could I resist? You know? So I dove in, and that was another one of my many obsessions.
Well, it sounds like you are in the business of helping other people become part of the same wonderful exploit that you have enjoyed as well. If people want to visit your website and learn more about the many things that you do and the many services that you offer, what is the address of that website?
So you can go to plantbasedservices.com. That'll get you, you know, to the main page. And I also have another domain, which is linked to my broom makers page there, which is broomsbylittlejohn.com. But both of those links will get you to my website in one form or another.
Very good. And those are beautiful brooms, I must say. They're actually breathtakingly beautiful. Who would have thought that a broom could be as lovely as this? So you're obviously a very, very talented and passionate guy, and I'm glad we've had the chance to talk with you about all that you do. John Holtzwart, thank you for being part of the morning show today here on WGTD.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
So, Nan, you're absolutely right. John Holtzwart is engaged in all kinds of intriguing and marvelous activity. I'd like to circle back to this nonprofit that he has created, and that, again, is still in its infancy, called Arboreus Incorporated, in which he has this vision of transforming some of the vacant spaces, particularly vacant lots right in the heart of Sheboygan and in other urban environments, and filling them with, among other things, fruit trees.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what's kind of your initial reaction to that possibility, and how do you see it perhaps being beneficial and applicable in other places as well?
You know, this is a really important thing that John is embarking upon for a number of different reasons. One is resource conservation. When we drive around our urban landscapes, and even sometimes in suburban landscapes, we see what we call vacant lots. They're lots that are growing turf, or they're growing, common weeds, or perhaps they're not even doing that. They're abandoned places. But sometimes they're mown with regularity, whether they should be or not. And then that's pretty much it. Sometimes they have a lot of impervious surface, so there's a lot of water slushing off of them. So when you transform a landscape like that into something that's green and growing and vibrant, you conserve water resources, you conserve petrochemical resources, and certainly you can conserve your community's municipal budget in terms of lands management. But more importantly, you can bring nutritious and healthy food to places that sometimes often don't have fresh produce. Sometimes we call them food deserts. And then you can begin engaging a community and actually transforming a community. And just very quickly, there was an endeavor here in Wisconsin outside of Madison, and there was an open space surrounded by a community, and the residents there had been using it for a very, very long period of time to grow fruits and vegetables, and a developer decided to buy it and build something on it. And it would have meant that something very important would have been taken away from that community in terms of fresh produce, and then coming together as a people, and also understanding different cultures. And so the community stepped in, and so did the university, and they were able to secure the land and hold it for the people in that community, and then also, enhance what people were doing at the time. So this is really all about community building, not just human community building, but environmental community building. And it would be very interesting, too, as this thing unfolds, maybe 10 years from now or 20 years from now, partnering up with a local land trust, because holding urban lands in trust in perpetuity would become a very important thing as time goes by, so that these things aren't undone and paved over. This takes a lot of work and a lot of love and commitment from people, and to see that undone in the sort of the stroke of a pen would be really heartbreaking.
Mm. And of course, that could very easily happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, something that appears to be empty and vacant and sometimes appearing even to be abandoned, mm-hmm. is most likely owned by somebody or something, mm-hmm. and at some point something could happen, and the potential for that to be transformed into green space would, for all intents and purposes, be gone.
Right, exactly. And just think about, all of these vacant lands being transformed into little food oases. Think of the potential for education, for nutrition education, for cultural education, what does this culture use this particular thing for, and how do we cook it, and how do we preserve it, how do we store it? And it's just rife with possibility and potential in a very, very positive, long-term way. So we wish John excellent luck with this.
Absolutely. Again, his nonprofit is called Arboreus Incorporated, and you can learn more about him at the websites that were mentioned. So, Nan, let's finish out with your calendar of events, events related to the environment.
We never lack for events here in our little neck of the woods. So to begin with, we have the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center, Bonk in the Barn, Saturday, and that's Bonk with an exclamation point, by the way, Saturday, August 11th from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. Bonk is a free monthly series featuring musical and literary performances in a variety of locations, and this is Bonk's seventh year with the Eco Justice Center. Come early and you can explore the beautiful grounds of the Eco Justice Center, then get settled in for poetry and music in the barn. Sounds
that
like
is
a lovely evening.
Yeah, Bonk is a very well-received series, mm-hmm. and but I don't remember it happening at the Eco Justice Center before.
Seven years. Come on, Greg.
No, but I mean, they've... Have they been at the Eco Justice Center?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's the seventh time.
Oh, that slipped past me, so that's exciting.
And so that is from 6 until 8 p.m. Then after that, on August 11th, all you need to do is drive over to Pringle Nature Center from 9:30 until 11 p.m., wherein you will be treated to viewing the Perseid meteor shower. Hopefully it'll be a nice, clear, cloudless evening. You do have to register, though. It's $3 for Friends of Pringle Nature Center and $5 for those of you who have yet to support Pringle Nature Center as a friend. There will be a short informal presentation before going outside to view. I'm certain that telescopes and viewing scopes, if you have your own, are more than welcome. So that'll be a lovely evening on August 11th.
Fantastic.
And then the following weekend, Hoy Audubon Society will be taking another field trip to the beautiful Horicon Marsh, Saturday, August 18th. Now, there are a variety of directions to follow and also a list of things to bring. So what I would encourage you to do is go to Hoy Audubon's website, hoyaudubon, that's one word, .org. You need to meet at the Auto Loop Trail parking area off of Highway 49 by 9 a.m. that morning on August 18th. But for detailed information, please go to Hoy Audubon's website.
Wonderful.
That's it.
Nan Calvert, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for helping us connect with John Holtzwart, and we look forward to seeing you in the beautiful month of September.
Thank you. I'll be here.
I'm Greg Rehberg. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Good morning. We are speaking for the next few minutes with one of the editors of Mental Floss, the book, The Greatest Lists in the History of Listery. And Ethan Trex is one of the editors of this really fun paperback from HarperCollins, which represents a full decade of what has been around on this website known as Mental Floss. Ethan Trex, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm just fine. So tell us how somebody gets a gig like this. I mean, dealing in the wonderful world of listery.
Oh, you gotta read a lot and get really good at writing down numbers and then writing paragraphs after them. We are all huge trivia buffs and just love going out and finding the weirdest, most fun, most informative stories we possibly can and bring them to our readers.
And how do you go about doing that? I mean, on kind of a typical search and secure sort of mission, what kinds of places do you go looking for this kind of offbeat information?
There is nothing more amazing than Google's newspaper archives that you can just go through, because you'll be looking for one thing and you'll find some paper from 1973 and you'll think, all right, well, this isn't exactly what I needed, but the adjacent story will be something insane. So you can just sort of thumb through old sources and then you start finding more and more fascinating stuff. If you read anything long enough, you're going to find a really good story.
So compare this book, Mental Floss, the book, to the actual website, which in a sense has spawned it. Is this sort of a greatest hits collection, a fairly representative sort of sampling, kind of a random sampling? What is the relationship between the website and this really fascinating, fun book?
Well, we have a website, and we actually started as a magazine. We still have our bi-monthly magazine that's sort of our flagship. So after 10 years of doing both the website and the magazine, we had just a huge archive of these great lists, and we kind of wanted to pull the best of them out and get those back out there to people so they could see, you know, if we wrote something that we really loved 7 years ago, people probably haven't seen it since, so we wanted to pull it out of the archives and let people see what our best stuff was.
Can you say a word about this great title, Mental Floss? Do you know anything about who exactly came up with that? Were you part of that decision?
No, I was not. Our magazine was founded at Duke University in 2001. It was founded in a dorm room by two students, and they came up with the name, and it's catchy. People remember it. It's great. But I don't know exactly how they did come up with it.
It is a great name. It, in a sense, is really fitting. It seems like a very nice, easy, entertaining mental workout. I mean, you've done yourself some good when you've done some reading through Mental Floss.
That's what we like to say, that if you read it, you'll pick it up, you'll be entertained. There's a lot of jokes in it. It's fun, and you'll learn a lot, but you won't feel like you're reading something dry and scholarly. You'll be smarter without knowing it.
Very good. So I have a couple of favorites that I'm going to ask you about, if you like, and then I'll give you a chance to highlight a couple of your favorite lists that are part of this. I thought in the first chapter called Cheat Sheets for Impressing a Diplomat, President, or Pope, I actually found myself rather rapidly skimming past the stuff related to politics and found myself instead most interested in five secrets of the Vatican being exposed. I learned some things here that I absolutely never heard of before.
What was that?
Well, for one thing, that there's a high crime rate at the Vatican. I mean, the highest crime rate in the world. Never knew that till I read Mental Floss.
Right. I mean, that's almost a math thing, because not that many people live there, but lots of people go to the Vatican as tourists or go there to go to mass. So it's pickpocket central, apparently.
Evidently.
Like 1.5 crimes each year per citizen of the Vatican, which is insane.
Hmm. A lot of the lists here are kind of crazy off-the-wall lists, but some of them really contain really good, solid, equally fascinating information. For instance, I really like the last list in the second chapter, lists that should come with a lab coat, which are all lists related to scientific matters of one kind or another. And the final list in that chapter is five ways museums detect forgeries. It's the kind of thing we know somebody knows a lot about, but typically it isn't us who knows very much about how that's done.
Oh, that stuff is fascinating. My favorite thing in that list is that when people are trying to verify that an old painting is real, you can look at these little cracks in the paint, and they don't crack randomly, so they crack in very specific ways. And if it's real, it will be cracked one way, and if it's fake, it will be cracked another. It's just so cool to look at.
Absolutely. Never knew that. I also, as someone who is in the middle of his life, been sort of rebitten by the Crayola crayon bug. I enjoyed reading about some of the retired Crayola crayons over the years and the reason why some of their colors have been retired over the years. Fun stuff.
Yeah, Prussian blue used to be a really popular crayon, but then I guess in the late 50s, after Prussia hadn't been a country for a long time, Crayola realized kids didn't know where Prussia was. So they changed it to Midnight Blue, which is a little less exciting.
Right. And, of course, it's interesting to read about how, understandably, Crayola felt compelled at some point, I think you say in the early 60s, to change the Crayola that had been called Flesh to Peach. Because, of course, Crayola knew, as well as all of the rest of us knew, that Flesh comes in all kinds of different colors. Lots of interesting information like that in this book. Why don't you tell us a couple of your favorite lists that we should seek out?
Oh, one of my favorite ones is we have a piece on five famous actors and the roles they turned down, because it's just amazing to think about these really famous movies, what they would have been like if they'd gotten their original casting choices. Like in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, they originally wanted Sean Connery to play Gandalf, and New Line Cinema, who was producing the movie, wanted him so badly they offered him 15% of the worldwide gross on the movie if he would take it, and he still turned it down, and obviously Ian McKellen played the part.
If he
had taken it, he would have gotten $400 million. It would have been the most lucrative role any actor had ever played.
Incredible. That just kind of makes you stop and shake your head, doesn't it? I mean, we just can't reimagine that.
At that point, you can barely even conceive of how much money that is, so I guess he's probably not kicking himself too hard. I mean, he was James Bond. He still has that going for him.
Right. And, of course, you talk about other celebrities, about famous books and what they were almost called, fun little things about children and babies, all kinds of things found in this fascinating book called Mental Floss, The Book. Only the greatest lists in the history of listry. This is a paperback from HarperCollins. And I had great fun reading this, Ethan Trex, and look forward to reading it again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Doug.
Tomorrow we look back on an extraordinary two-week event at Carthage under the auspices of the National Endowment of the Humanities. Women's Suffrage in the Americas. Almost 50 scholars from all around the Western Hemisphere gathered at Carthage to explore how women's suffrage emerged in all of the countries of North and South America. I'll be talking with several different participants. And on Thursday, you'll hear my conversation with Bill Schneider, formerly the political analyst for CNN. Our forecast today is for variable cloudiness today, a 40% chance of afternoon rain showers, a high of 79 degrees, cloudy with some patchy fog re-developing tonight, and a low of 63, sunny tomorrow, and a high of 82 degrees. We're approaching 9 o'clock, and you're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.